Sai Ram, dear listeners, this is Radio Sai Answering Booth and welcoming you to this show. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. Warm good evening, and even as I say that, our evenings in Parthi are getting as warm as they are good. Today is what is a day referred to as Ides of March, a phrase made famous by the dialogue "Beware of the Ides of March" from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Well, when with Swami, we don't have to be frightened or of anything or beware of anything in that sense. But nevertheless, as Swami would say, we must be alert and aware all the time. Swami would quote Adi Shankara and say, "Tasmat jagrata, jagrata, jagrata." Be alert, be alert, be alert all the time. Desires, passions, likes, worries, fear, they pull us hither and thither and make us falter. Jagrata, jagrata, jagrata. Praying that the love for Swami that we have in our hearts becomes the source of that alertness, let us offer our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Today coming up on the show, I have quite a general question, so the answer is going to be quite general too and applicable to most of us, I guess. Let's hope it is that way. But before that, I have a beautiful quote to share with all of you. Mysticism is synonymous with the person of the name of this person whose quote I'm going to be reading out today. There is a certain spiritual intoxication in his name itself, if I could say that. His words are so simple, but it literally redefines the idea of profundity itself. They are so mystically deep. Some of you might have guessed it already. Yes, I'm going to be reading out a quote by Sufi mystic Rumi. I quote, "Knock and he'll open the door. Vanish and he'll make you shine like the sun. Fall and he'll raise you to the heavens. Become nothing and he will turn you into everything." End of quote. What a beautiful verse that is, dear listeners. Knock and he will open the door. How many of us knock at the door of the Lord? And even when we do, how many have the patience and perseverance to continue to knock his door? We knock a few times and we walk away when the door is not answered. Whose loss is it if we turn away from his door? Knock and be sure he'll open the door. If the door hasn't opened, he is just walking even ever so closer to the door with every moment of silence. Vanish and he'll make you shine. All our life is spent in trying to become something, achieve something. If at all we pursue the art of vanishing or sublimating this complex yet ever so trivial ego, that is when he will truly make us shine, isn't it? As Swami was once telling, do you think Saint Tyagaraja or Mother Meera sat and composed songs with the feeling that one day they will become popular numbers? They lost themselves in devotion, and so they live on to this day in their songs. This is an important quote for those of us who are in the path of devotion, and I suppose that most of us are. We take to this path drawn by the most attractive persona of Swami. Well, that is the hidden blessing when an avatar descends. It is so easy to be drawn to him, and thereby to this path of devotion. And this path of devotion, Swami would say, is the art of becoming nothing. From ahankara or pride to dasoham or the humility of servitude. But having taken to this path, instead of focusing all our energies in becoming nothing, even on this path, we start gathering and adding to our ego. I have spent so many years more than you with Swami. I have been so much more closer physically. I do more seva than others. I have sacrificed more than others. I am a Sai student, and so on. In the path where the ego is to be sublimated, the ego now takes a very subtle form and keeps growing, a development that is indeed dangerous. Then what can we do to not get trapped in this quicksand? Tasmat jagrata, jagrata, jagrata. Be aware and alert all the time. Consciously, diligently, become nothing. But though Rumi says become nothing and he'll make you into everything, let our focus not be in gaining everything. When God turns us into everything, it is not in the sense of possessing everything or possessing limitless name and fame, but becoming the universal proprietor to whom all names belong, to whom all wealth belongs. All fame is only a part of his glory. When we become nothing and then become everything, we don't grow in possession, but we become that. We become that one who is the basis of all possessions. Before we head to the question, dear listeners, permit me to read that profound quote by the Sufi mystic Rumi one more time. I quote, "Knock and he will open the door. Vanish and he'll make you shine like the sun. Fall and he'll raise you to the heavens. Become nothing and he'll turn you into everything." Let's head to the question that we have this week then. The question today is from a regular listener from Sharjah, Sister Purna, who has sent us a few questions before too. As I mentioned in the beginning, it's a general question. It's a brief one. So I thought I'll read it out myself today. So here's the question from Sister Purna. Sai Ram, my question is, how to know if I'm doing my duty with love or doing it just as a duty? The second question is, how to develop unconditional love for someone with whom I am having repeated confrontations? We understand that a situation repeats till we learn something out of it. Most often, I don't know what I'm supposed to learn. Maybe that I don't have real love for that person. So if I learn to love unconditionally, then I would have learned what I'm supposed to. Please clarify. As I said, it's a very general question. It's not pertaining to any specific situation, but something which most of us would probably encounter. And if we are not encountering, then I think it's quite weird because most of us will be in situations like that. Almost a year ago, I'd answered a very similar question. And this question specifically made a reference to one quote of Swami, that is, duty without love is deplorable. So how do you bring love into our, how do we bring love into our duty? And I think the answer that I gave for that particular question is quite applicable to this question. I had spoken about how seeing Swami in others literally transforms our duty towards people in our workplace and family, and how it varies in different situations. That was the answer I had given. And the reason I'm saying that the answer that I gave there is pretty much applicable to this question is because one part of that question that I answered a year ago was about how do I bring love into a relationship to which I am bound by duty, right? That's why it's pretty similar to the question that's being asked here, that how do I bring love to a relationship where you have constant confrontations. And when you say constant confrontations, which means that it is a relationship which you cannot run away from, which you cannot overlook, which means it's a duty-bound relationship. So the question of how do you bring love into a relationship where you have constant bombardments and confrontations, I think that's why that answer which I gave there is very applicable here. So one of the techniques that I gave in response is for how for most of us Swami's devotees trying to see Swami and the other person in different scenarios, you know, when the other person is a stranger with whom we will probably interact very briefly, or if it's the person whom, you know, who's a part of our family or who's a part of our workplace whom we'll be interacting with more often, how in these various scenarios seeing Swami in that person is supposed to change our approach and how knowing it we can consciously do that. But today, in response to this question, I think I'll address the issue in a little different way. In fact, I had mentioned this in that answer too, in the answer which I gave a year ago. Honestly, if I had not gone back to the answer and referred, I wouldn't have realized that I made a mention of it there. So even for those who have already heard that answer, I hope that what I'm going to say today will be a revision of whatever was said there, just like how it's going to be a revision for me too. To start with, you know, there's a general misconception that we all have. We use this word love, I would say, quite wrongly when we, compared to when we look at it from Swami's perspective. When we use this word love in our regular parlance, in our regular conversation, in fact, even in this question, we use it quite wrongly, but when we look at it from Swami's point of view, from the perspective of Swami's message, the idea of love is actually quite different from the way we use that word. When we say, I don't love this person, or I have duty towards this person, but I don't have any love for him or her, what we are actually meaning is, I don't like this person, or I don't have any fondness for this person. It is not the idea of love. Because this concept of love is a very fundamental expression, if I could put it that way. And by nature, love is actually not dependent on who the recipient is. How loving I am is actually my quality. It's got nothing to do with the people around me or their nature. If I am a loving person, then I'm capable of a certain amount of love. If I'm not a person who is capable of being loving, then I think it's completely my nature. It's though there are trigger points outside, though the interactions that we have with those around us makes us appear like a loving person or a not very loving person, it is our nature, right? So love is a very, very fundamental expression. It's not got to do with anything about what the people around are, right? In fact, there's a very beautiful quote. I'm sure I must have mentioned this before in this program too. And it's worth repeating here, where they say that, you know, love is a very fundamental quality of us. And it's just that the exact words of that quote is, you know, when the eye is unobstructed, sight happens. And similarly, when the heart is unobstructed, love happens. The idea of the quote is, you know, you don't have to do anything to love. Love is already there, just like how you don't have to do anything to see. The moment the obstruction from in front of your eye is removed, the eye just sees. And similarly, the moment the obstructions which are there in the heart are removed, love just happens. I mean, that's your nature. That is your very essential nature, right? For now, let's go back to this idea of liking and disliking, or being fond of somebody or not being fond of somebody. As I said, though we use the words, the word pair of love and hate, you know, that's what we often use in our regular usage. Either you love somebody or hate someone. But actually, it is not love and hate, it is like and hate. And in Sanskrit, we use the words, again, something which I've mentioned many times on this show, raga and dvesha. And raga means, it's of course a word which has many meanings. One of it is to like something or to be attached to something or to be fond of something. And dvesha is not to have a liking for something, or it could even be a very strong form of dislike, right? So when we say love and hate, we are actually referring to raga and dvesha, which is actually like and hate, not love and hate. And this complex of what I like and what I don't like is literally what defines me as a personality. How am I different from somebody else who works with me, or how am I different from you? How are you different from anybody else in your family? I think if we look at our personalities, it is nothing but a very exhaustive list of what are the things I like, what are the things I don't like, right? That's what makes me different as a person. That's what makes you different as a person. This entire conglomeration of things that we like and dislike is what defines us as a person. Now, this like and dislike, just like how I was referring to the words raga and dvesha, can be of varying levels, right? I might have an extremely strong liking for something. I might feel that I can't live without this particular thing or this particular person, right? Or I might just like something, or, you know, I might just be happy if it comes along. I could have that sort of a, I mean, all of this comes under the idea of like. And similarly, I might dislike something or very passionately hate something, or I might say that, you know, I'm not very fond of this. Or, I mean, given a choice, I'll not go for this. But if it comes, I'm not going to be too upset about it. So when I say like and dislike, when I say raga and dvesha, and when I say that like and dislike is what literally defines our personality, it is this comprehensive list of things that we mildly like to very, very attach to. Similarly, what with things which we are not very fond of, we're not very keen about, and about things that we are literally, we cannot stand, we are allergic to them, similarly like that. So these things, this raga and dvesha, is what we are, is what we, our essential personality is. I wouldn't say essential personality, the personality or the characteristics which distinguish you from me and me from the others, right? That is what this raga and dvesha is. If we completely do away with this, we become what we refer to in the spiritual field as a yogi. Right? A yogi is one who has perfect union, which means he does not have any preference at all. There's nothing that he likes more than something else, or there's nothing that he dislikes more than something else. But for all of us, you and me, who are all in this path, who are all still progressing and taking steps very gradually, I think this like and dislike will remain in us for a very long time to come. We cannot overlook them. We cannot, as I always say, wish them away, right? That's what defines our personality, and we have to work with these likes and dislikes. Now, what is love in all of this? As I said, it is not love, but it is like. So what is love in all of this? Love is something which is a more fundamental quality which is there in each one of us. A person may appear very kind, a person may appear very rude, a person may appear very loving, a person may appear very patient. There might be a person who's, you know, everybody likes that person. There might be someone who's like, who's a pain for everybody. But the fact is, as Swami says, there is love in everybody, and that love is absolute. And isn't that why Swami would often, when he starts a discourse, he would often say, Prema Swarupa, right? He would say that you're all, whether you acknowledge it or not, whether you behave like that or not, you're all forms of love. You're all Prema Swarupa. You're all embodiments of love. So in that sense, Swami would say that this divinity within the, love is just another name for that divinity. That's what Swami would often say, right? Love is God and God is love. So when we say that we are essentially God, we are essentially divine, the characteristic of this divinity which is within each one of us is love. So it is not about me not capable of loving something or me not being able to love someone, because that is my nature. That is already there, right? There is nothing that stops me from being that. But when we like something, when we say that I'm fond of this, the love that is within shows up in that particular scenario more spontaneously, right? So the things, the people, situations that we don't like, there, I think the love that is inherent within us does not express spontaneously, which we define as hatred or disinterest, depending on the, as I said, levels of dislike, right? So this is actually the picture which, when we use these words, love and hate and like, we don't realize this. This is the spiritual model or the spiritual sketch of what we really are, as Swami says. In the core, we are divine, and that divine's nature is love. But outside, we are this personality, and this personality is defined by what we like and what we don't like, and that's what makes us unique, because we have different sets of likes and dislikes. You know, what do we do when we are left alone? What are the things that we choose to do? What are the things that we choose to do with ourselves? And that is what defines us. And this love which is there in each one of us literally shines through things which we like. And for a regular person, something which he or she likes, the love becomes spontaneous. You know, it just comes out. And the things which one does not like, or one hates, or one has disinterest towards, one is not fond of, that love showing up is not very spontaneous, right? Before I go ahead, let me make this very clear that this is a very simplified portrayal of the human personality. Of course, you know, it's a far more complex thing than this. You know, you have, as Swami would say, that the Arshad Vargas of Kama, Krodha, Moha, Madhamatsarya, all of that, it's a very complex thing what we talk of as the human personality. But just for the sake of simple understanding, just for the sake of putting it across, for the sake of this question, I'm putting it like this. So it is, as we always say, it's like high school physics. We do a lot of assumptions. We ignore a lot of factors which are going to complicate our equation. And then we progress and solve and say, thus proved, right? That's what we generally do. And that's what we're going to do here. It's a very simplified portrayal of human personality. I know that. I'm acknowledging that. I'm not telling you to define everything by this, but just for an understanding. So this is the model. Keep in mind that we're all divine, as Swami says, and that nature of that divinity is to be loving. Love is the nature or the quality of that divinity. And literally covering that essential nature of love are these likes and dislikes, or raga and dvesha. So we either like something or we dislike something, but essentially the love is always there. Now, coming to the idea of the spiritual path, you know, when we take to a spiritual path, what is it that happens? Now, I've simplified the idea of what the human personality is. Now, what do we tend to do in the spiritual path, or what are we supposed to try to do when we take to a spiritual path? It's actually twofold, two things that we have to do with reference to these likes and dislikes. One is constantly we are supposed to refine this idea of likes and dislikes. The second thing is, we refine the way we respond to our likes and dislikes. I'll repeat that. The spiritual path is actually twofold. One is refinements of our likes and dislikes. And the second is the way we respond to our likes and dislikes. In fact, it is more specifically the way we respond to what we don't like or what we are not fond of. But for now, we'll put it as the way we respond to our likes and dislikes. What do I mean by saying that refinement of likes and dislikes? Because as I said, our personality or this person, me as Prem or each one of you as who you are, is defined by your likes and dislikes. So when we say someone is a noble person or someone is a very, a very straightforward person or someone is a very materialistic person or someone is a very simple person, what we are referring to is this complex of likes and dislikes. So if I'm a very materialistic person and I want to become a person who's probably more in tune with what Swami expects of his devotees, what I'm going to essentially do is refine my likes and dislikes. The things which I liked in the past are going to be changed to what I'm going to be liking in the future. The things I was repelled from, or the things which I'm going to be repelled from now, might have been a part of the likes, the list of likes previously, right? So when we say that we're getting transformed, it is essentially these refinements of likes and dislikes, because that's literally what defines our personality. So if you give me some money, what do I choose to do with that money that you give me? How do I choose to spend it, right? I like to buy something. I like to do something else. So that is what defines me. Similarly, you give me a day off. I'm working here. You give me a day off. What do I try to do with that day? Given that day, what do I do? How do I spend that time? That is what defines me, right? That is what who I am. Similarly, we've all been given a life. What do we do with that life? What do we like to do with it? What do we don't like to do with it? What do we like to do with our time? What we don't like to waste our time on? That is what literally defines us, right? So the first aspect or the first part of the spiritual process that we are undergoing is, you know, how do I refine this likes and dislikes? And more importantly, as Swami would say, that if you are left alone, if you are unwatched, if you are unmonitored, what do you choose to do? Swami would say that that's what literally defines you. When you know that you will never be found out, how do you spend your time? And that is essentially what we are, the likes and dislikes which define us. So in one hand, when we say that we are spiritually progressing, when we are trying to align our lives to the way Swami expects from us, align our lives in the way that Swami wants a Sai student to live or the way Swami wants a Sai devotee to live, what we are essentially doing is we are refining our tastes. We are refining what we like. We are refining what we don't like. How do we spend our time? How do we spend our energies? How do we spend our money? The second part that I mentioned is the way I respond to likes and dislikes. And I also said that to be more precise, how I respond to what I don't like. Like I said, love is there in each one of us. It's the inner core. But in situations where we are fond of a person, we like a person, or we like doing a certain thing, in such times, I am happy spontaneously, or I am happy doing that spontaneously. I am happy doing that for that person very, very spontaneously, right? But my true character is, if I come across somebody whom I don't like, how am I able to manage my situation then? Or rather, how loving am I able to be to a person who is not actually to my fondness or to my likeness, right? How I respond to that person, or how I let my love, which is there within, flow towards this person, is what really is a test of my character, isn't it? A person who's very, very transparent in that sense of, you know, if they don't like you, they speak rudely to you, they speak harshly to you, or, you know, when they feel that they don't have any necessity to engage with you in a loving manner, if they are rude and harsh, that is what their nature is. But if you find somebody who, you know, I might go and trouble that person, I might be irritating that person, but still that person is very patient with me, is very tolerant with me, and he's kindly trying to explain. That is what defines that person as a good person or a person of noble qualities, right? So on one hand, we are trying to refine our likes and dislikes. That's the transformation that we all have to go through. The other hand is this idea of making our love independent of our like and dislike. That's what I meant by saying the way we respond to our likes and dislikes, primarily the way we respond to our dislikes or situations or people whom we are not fond of. How loving or how much love can I spontaneously bring forth in a situation where it is involving a person whom I am not very fond of? Now, the next few minutes, what I'll try to do is, we come across many, many people in our life. We come across many situations in our life. Our life is very complex. It's, you know, from our childhood to our youth to our productive years in our middle years when we are earning a lot, when we are, you know, managing a family, and then towards the later part of our life. We come across many, many people, and if we can categorize all of these people and all of the situations that these people are involved in with us into four very broad categories, and I will talk about how this idea of bringing unconditional love, because that's the question, that's what the question is about. And if we were to divide all of these people and scenarios that we come across into four categories based on this idea of likes and dislikes, and bringing in the idea of duty, right? That's what was the other important aspect of that question, as I said, because the idea is, you know, here is a person you're constantly having confrontations with, you're constantly having to interact with this person, but you're not very fond of this person, you're not very comfortable with this person, so how do I bring love there? So automatically the idea of duty comes into that picture. So the four categories of people, broadly categorized, as I reiterate again, are: one category is, I like, but I am not duty bound. The second category is, I don't like, and I am not duty bound to that person. The third category is, I like, and I am duty bound to that person. And the fourth category is, I don't like, but I am duty bound. The most toughest one, which the question is about. So I hope you followed me. There are four categories based on these likes and dislikes and our duty, which is, I like, but I'm not duty bound. I don't like, and I'm not duty bound. I like, and I am duty bound. I don't like, but I'm duty bound. Now, let us take duty as inevitable, duty as a constant. If we look at our own lives, I think many times we fail in our duty. Many times we're not sure how much our duty is. Sometimes we don't do. I mean, that's a different aspect. Let's take the baseline as we all have to do our duty. We acknowledge the fact that if there is a duty, whether I like it or not, whether that person is very likable to me or not, I have to go in and do my duty. So we're going to take the idea that the duty has to be done, duty is inevitable, as the basis, the starting point from which we will go further. So the people who don't do their duty at all, I think we will keep them out of the discussion for now. So we will take it that all of us are duty bound, we are adhering to our duty. When we fix duty as inevitable, these two categories that come under not duty bound, that is, I like this person, or I like to be in this scenario, but I'm not duty bound to be here or to interact with this person. I don't like this person or this scenario, and I am not duty bound. When we say that adhering our duty is inevitable, that is the place where we don't have a choice. So these two categories where we say that I am not duty bound, this is the place where we have the choice, right? These are the two categories of people and scenarios where we have the choice. I like it, so I'm doing it. I don't like it, I don't have to force myself to do it, because I'm not going to be failing in my duty by not doing this, right? So this is the category where this idea of choice comes. And when it comes to refining our likes and dislikes, as I said, it is here that we have the opportunity. The company we choose, we are not duty bound to, you know, be with this person. We are not duty bound to do this particular activity, but we choose to do this, right? And when we say company, it's not just the company of people, the company of books, the company of the media that we have, the company of how we spend our time. What are we going to be doing to spend our time? So there is no question of if I'm not doing this or if I'm not interacting with this person, I'll be failing in my duty. So it's completely up to my choice. And what we choose is what defines the way we are. So when we say that, when Swami says, avoid bad company or keep good company, keep noble company, satsangatve nisangatvam, as Swami would say, for instance, you might be sitting and listening to this program. You're not duty bound to listen to this program. You're not duty bound to listen to Radio Sai. But if you choose to spend your time listening to this, I think that's a choice, right? You are not, if you're not listening, nobody's going to question you, why are you not listening? But you have made this choice. So these two categories, which are not duty bound, where you like or you may not like, is the category where you have the comfort of choice. And when we say that one aspect of our spiritual journey is refinement of likes and dislikes, this is where we have the opportunity. I'm not duty bound to do this, but I make a choice, right? The other extension of this, whatever I've said, sometimes we are duty bound to a person, but we are not duty bound to be with that person beyond a certain time. You know, there are situations like that also. I mean, a typical example of that is, let's say that you have a colleague, right? You're duty bound to work with that colleague. He's working in your team or she's working in your team. You have to work with that person. But if you choose to hang out with that person after your office hours, that becomes your choice, right? That now goes to that aspect of your life where you're not duty bound, but you choose to be with that person. There's a very beautiful incident which one of the lecturers was once narrating. This was like in the early years of the Satya Sai College. The college had just started in Puttaparthi, and it was, in fact, the building had not yet come up. The classes used to happen in the Ishwarama school, what is the Ishwarama English Medium School now. In that building, I think one of the floors were taken over by the college which was there. So I think this was narrated by Professor Gangadhar Shastri, who is still a professor in our university. He teaches political science. So he would say that in that time, a lot of these people who had joined Swami's college were not necessarily Swami's devotees, or they did not come for the opportunity of being with Swami. Many of them were young graduates. In fact, like him, he himself, he did not know of Swami before he came and joined the university. He had just graduated, he had just got married, he was looking for a better opportunity in his career. He saw this offer of a new college starting, so he came and applied and he got the job. So he was saying that many of the teachers of those years, the early years of the university, were all teachers like this, who came purely drawn by the career opportunity which the university provided. So he would say that they would teach till about 4:30 or something, they would have classes, and after that the students would all proceed to Mandir. The teachers, most of them, actually were not, in that sense, duty bound to come to Mandir, right? So what would happen is, invariably, the teachers who were there would literally split into two groups. One group would go towards the Gokulam side, which is away from the Mandir, and there used to be a tea shop or something there. They used to sit there and they used to have tea. Some of them used to even smoke. And some of the other teachers would, you know, though they were not duty bound to come to Mandir, they would come and sit in the Mandir because of the opportunity of interacting with Swami. So one day, apparently, he was sitting in the portico and Swami came and asked him, what happened? Where are your other colleagues? I don't see many of them here. So then I think, I don't recall exactly the details of how the conversation went. Either he said or Swami told him that they've all gone to the tea shop and they're having tea there. And in a very casual remark, Swami said, you know, whoever has taken to the other side, you know, literally Ishwarama school is right in the middle. On the other side is the Gokulam, on this side is the Mandir, right? So Swami said, all those who go that side will go away like that itself, and all those who come this side will stay. And similarly, after so many years, Gangadhar Shastri sir is still here, he's a professor, and he's still inspiring all our students. But most of the teachers of that time who chose not to come to Mandir and chose to spend their time otherwise, I mean, they eventually moved on, right? So that's what I was saying, that what we choose to do where our duty is not making it mandatory is what is the company that we keep. When Swami says, have good company or refine the company that you keep, choose what you do with your time wisely. All of this comes under these two categories, where you don't have duty that is binding you to a certain person or a certain scenario or a certain work, but you have the choice. And here, to start with, we do what we like. We avoid what we don't like. If there is a person whom we don't like and we are not duty bound to interact with that person, you can stay away from that person. You don't have to go and, you know, test your own levels of patience. Of course, if you want to do that, you can always do that. But if you're not duty bound to interact with a person and you're not very fond of that person, to start with, I think you can keep away. You don't have to try and engage with that person. So that aspect of refining our likes and dislikes falls under this category. Now the question is about the other category where duty comes into the picture. I like and I'm duty bound. Well, this is the sweet spot, right? If I'm duty bound to do something and I also like to do what I'm doing, I mean, that's the most charming aspect of our life, right? I mean, most of us at radio say like that. We like to do what we are doing and we are duty bound to do that. And many, many people might be there. You know, you might be in a profession which you're very, which you took up with much fondness and you're happy to be in the profession. Many doctors are like that. Many teachers are like that. You know, they like the profession of teaching and they've gone into teaching. When a mother performs a duty, it's like that, right? The mother enjoys doing whatever she does for her child and she's also duty bound to do that, right? So when you love your profession and you're engaging in your duty, or when you're like a mother or a parent who's fond of the child and is performing his duty, or there's a couple who are fond of each other and they're doing duties to each other, right? All of this is probably the sweet spot, or this is what actually keeps us going. We all, whether we agree or not, all of us in our life will have something of this aspect where we are supposed to do something and we also like doing that. I think if we say that there is nothing like that in my life, we probably are not looking close enough. All of us, I think this is probably the grace of Swami. And this is the one thing which probably keeps us going, right? We are doing our dharma and we are also enjoying the course of doing our dharma. So all of us, to some extent, will have some part of our activity or some part of our interaction, some part of our duty falling in this sweet spot, falling in this place where it is very nice. So when you ask this question, I think that was the first question that the listener asked. You know, how will I know that I'm doing my duty with love? Well, this is how it is. You will do it so very effortlessly when you doing your duty and you like doing it. And that's when your love spontaneously pours out doing that duty, right? There's no effort in that. You know, a mother never feels tired with what she's doing. Or as they would say that, like somebody who is in business, who is like so fascinated about very passionate about his business or her business, when they're involved in their work, I mean, they forget their sleep, they forget their appetite, they're happy to do what they're doing because, you know, they're enjoying that the doing that becomes so very effortless, right? That's when the duty and love are actually coming together. But the problem with this thing is, it's a very enriching category that some of our activities fall in. We like doing it and we also have to do it, so we are enjoying it. But the problem with this is we don't learn much in this category, right? We only enjoy ourselves doing that. There's nothing much to really learn from the spiritual point of view. The toughest and the most important and where maximum learning happens and the maximum spiritual progress can take place, that opportunity is there, is where I am duty bound, but I may not have a liking or fondness to do that particular duty or perform that particular duty towards this person or one particular individual whom I'm not very fond of. Right? This is where it is toughest. This is where the question is related to. But this is the one category where there is maximum opportunity to learn. As I said, the spiritual path is twofold. One is refinement of likes and dislikes. The other is how we respond to situations and people to whom we are duty bound, but we do not like or where there is no fondness, right? So this is that category where we can learn that. As I said, this is where the question also lies in, the question about, you know, how do I learn to love unconditionally? And this is the category which will test us as to how our love expresses in spite of who is the person in front of us, right? But before I move ahead, a quick word of caution, and I repeat this, I've said this even in that answer to that question that I gave a year ago, you know, it was based on this particular quote, as I said, duty without love is deplorable. So I think most people ask that, you know, when the love in a relationship goes off, when a love in a duty-bound relationship is no more there to be seen, does that mean we have to give up on that relationship? Because when you say that duty without love is deplorable, so when there is no love, do we give up the duty? Right? It does not mean that. If love ebbs out of a relationship, it does not mean that you break away from that duty. Duty is the basis. I think that's why we said that you have to keep that constant, that duty is inevitable. If there is no love in a relationship like that, then we must find ways of bringing love there, not abandon duty, right? So on one hand, we choose the right company of people, books, media, pastime, all of that, right? And keep away from the people who can trouble us and irritate us. That is because we are not duty bound to them. But this category of people and situations whom we are duty bound to, but are capable of irritating us, is the place where we can try to make our love unconditional, or in other words, non-dependent on the nature of the person in front of us or the nature of our interaction with that person. Now if you look at it, you know, if you look at it as these four categories, you see that this is such a small part of our life, right? We burden ourselves with this idea that we want to show unconditional love to everyone, right? But all that we need to do is work on this one particular aspect of all these four categories, this very small aspect where we are duty bound and that person is probably getting under our skin. How do we show love in that situation? An irritating person at work, a bad neighbor, or a relationship where that person is not very likable, right? This is literally like our spiritual gym, right? See, if I want to become physically strong, I don't have to keep carrying weights all the time. I mean, that's not how I'm going to become physically muscular. I just go into a gym and work out for half an hour a day or five times a week, half an hour a day. And what happens is overall my strength increases. It does not mean that I'm going to be strong only in that when I'm in the gym. When you work out in the gym and you don't have to carry around weights all the time, you just do it for that limited period in that space. But overall, your strength increases, right? So similarly, if my behavior becomes more and more loving towards this category, then in general, I will become more and more loving. The more and more I can try to become, make this love unconditional towards this category of people, because when we talk about unconditional love, it is only in this category we can try it out, right? Because everywhere else it's about likes. I like it, I'm doing it. I don't like it, I can keep away. This is the only category where we are forced to do it, whether we like it or not. So this is the one category where we can practice that unconditional love, right? So this is literally like the spiritual gym for us, this category of people, and that is precisely the reason why we should not run away from this particular category. In fact, as I'm talking about the idea of a gym, there are a lot of things that, a lot of parallels that can be drawn from what you undergo in a gym in that sense, and this category of people and how you deal with them. I don't know if the questioner can directly relate to this idea of, you know, what happens in a gym, but I'll share it anyway for those who probably can relate to that. You know, in life, most of the time we try to avoid pain. That's how we maneuver through our life. Where there is pain, we avoid it. Where there is a chance of pain, we try to do things that we don't encounter that pain. But probably the gym is one of the few places where you go in search of pain, right? Literally in that sense, you go into that gym hoping that you will do something by which your limbs and your legs will start paining, right? That is one particular place where you go in search of pain, because when you feel pain in your limbs, in your body, you're actually happy because it's a sign that you're getting stronger, right? Take the same concept, take the same idea and apply it in that idea of you going into this category of I'm duty bound, but I don't like this person, I don't like this scenario, I don't like to do this. So this is literally like the category you are going in, acknowledging that there is going to be pain, there's going to be a struggle, there's going to be a difficulty here. But it is like walking into the gym. I know that there is going to be pain at the end of the session I'm going to be here, but I'm going in search of this pain because this is the pain which actually makes me stronger, right? And finally, most importantly, I think there's a very famous quote by one of the bodybuilders. I don't recall the quote verbatim, where he says that let's say that you go into a gym and you do 20 bench presses or any such exercise, and you're absolutely exhausted, you've given up, you don't have any more strength to even do one more. So they say that let's say that you've really drained out all your energy, and after that, if you do even 2 or 3 bench presses or 2 or 3 reps of that particular exercise, the growth of your strength that happens in that 2 or 3 exercises that you do is much more than what you got of that initial 20. Again, this is something you need to take to that idea of you going into this category of people where you know that there is going to be pain, there is going to be a little bit of friction, where you've held out your patience for, let's say, 20 minutes or 1 week or whatever it is, depending on the nature of that relationship. For every bit more that you hold out thinking that, no, this is the last straw, I can't take this anymore, every bit that you push yourself and you tolerate that person or show a little more forbearance towards that person, that much you will go stronger. And when you have totally given up and when you push yourself, the amount of growth that happens at that extra push that you do is much more than, the casual build-up of your patience you're losing out your patience. So literally when you go into situations like this, first of all, acknowledge, you first acknowledge that I know that this is going to be a tough situation. I know that I don't have a liking towards this person, but I know that if I'm talking about unconditional love, here is an opportunity for me. Because I know that this person is not going to respond in a way that is probably the way I would want him to or want her to. But I'm going to be as loving as possible without expecting that return from this person. Literally with that acknowledgement, and this is the opportunity that we have with relationships like this. So when we go through life, we need all these things, right? It's not that as I said, you can't keep carrying weights all day long. You just have to do it for a few minutes or an hour a day and you'll become strong all the time, right? So we can't constantly look for people that we don't like and try to keep engaging with them. And that is why when we go through life, we need all of this, the freedom to choose what we like, the need to be loved, or the need for response for our love. But also there is a very important necessity for this category where it is not easy, because as we are going through life, we need both of these balances. We need to keep ourselves sane. We need to keep ourselves nourished intellectually and nourished mentally or emotionally, more than intellectually, emotionally. We need emotional nourishment, and that comes from these categories of people doing things which we like, or doing for people whom we like. That is where our nourishment comes from. But if all that we get is only nourishment, then I think what it leads to is obesity. So you need some challenges in life too. And that challenge comes from this aspect. So this is the balance that we all need to go. And literally, let's say that tomorrow there's somebody who takes up a career and they end up in a job which they're not very fond of, and let's say that has become their duty. Yes, at some point you can move on, but at that particular time, if you're stuck up in that job and your duty is to do what you're doing, so what you can do is you can manipulate on this particular category which falls on not duty bound, as I said, where there is a choice. You take up a pastime, you take up a hobby, you take up something out of your own volition, of your own choice, which you like doing, right? So you get your emotional replenishment from that category, and it gives you the strength to go and do this particular tough job. You know, I don't like this, but I've got to do this, and work on how you can become more spontaneous in your unconditional love in this particular category. Generally, what we try to do, and the mistake that all of us do, is, you know, we try to fill our life with just the things that we like and the things that we like to do, right? Yes, there is momentary happiness in filling our lives with things that we like, right? I mean, it's not wrong to, as I said, doing it in things where you're not duty bound, but we start doing this even when it comes to relationships. I'm not able to put up with my parents and I move away. And this relationship is not working, so let's part ways. Or I don't like my son, I'm going to send him away. Whatever it is, you know, when we are constantly progressing in life, only gathering around us what we like, what we are fond of, and we turn away from things that we are not fond of, it's yes, probably a little happiness will be there. There will be a little bit of happiness, but that happiness is momentary. At some point, we're going to look back and say that, you know, there will be a certain amount of emptiness, right? That's the whole idea of the spiritual journey. On the other hand, if you're completely stuck with people and scenarios that where, you know, you're not able to find love, you're not able to find any happiness, I think then you'll only end up being sad, right? There is, as they say, all work and no play makes Tom, Jimmy, or whatever the name is, a dull person, right? That's what happens. If it's all about learning, then you become sad. You need learning. At the same time, you need these aspects of life where your love is responded to, where you're allowed to do something that you like, where you also pursue something which you're fond of, which, of course, that's a different topic altogether, which is within the limits of propriety, within the limits of what Swami says is right and wrong. If you're able to do that, you can maintain your sanity. All of the other categories are meant for that. But this one particular category where I am duty bound, but I'm not very fond of this person, is like that spiritual gym that you walk into. Go in with the acknowledgement, this is difficult. Go in with the idea that yes, I'm doing this because I want to learn to love unconditionally. And the more and more we learn unconditional love, as I said, it becomes a nature. I mean, when we say unconditional love, what it is the second aspect of the spiritual journey that we spoke about. How I respond to my likes and dislikes. The way I respond to things and people I dislike will become more and more similar to the way I respond to situations and people I like. The amount of love I'm able to bring out in a situation where a person that I like or I'm fond of is there becomes very similar to the amount of love I'm able to bring to a situation where I'm interacting with a person I don't like. In other words, this idea of likes and dislikes, raga and dvesha, literally start melting away, right? That is the whole idea. As I said in the beginning, I said, when you completely sublimate likes and dislikes, you become a yogi. That is what it means to be in union with God. And the way it happens is this: to bring unconditional love, the way I respond to a person or a situation that I don't like will become more and more similar to my reaction in situations where it involves persons I like, right? So this unconditional love becomes my nature in a way where the likes and dislikes completely start dissolving. I didn't go into how do you practice this unconditional love because, as I said, that is what I covered in that answer a year ago where I said, for us as Swami's devotees, the easiest thing is to bring Swami into the picture. Because we will be encountering a lot of people whom we like, we don't dislike. Instead of working towards each person as an individual, okay, here is this person, let me say, how do I start loving that person? Instead of that, we direct all our love towards one person, that is Swami, and we make Swami literally like the filter through which we give love to everybody else. And we say that, you know, I'm not expecting anything from this person because I'm actually directing my love towards the Swami in this person. If the Swami in this person does not choose to respond to my love, the Swami in some other person is going to respond to that love. That's a very, very effective way. I mean, if anybody's interested, probably you can go back to that answer, which I gave in the February of 2017. If you're interested, you can always write to me. I'll direct you to that answer. But this is the whole process of us going through this unconditional, through this process of learning to show unconditional love. It is there in each one of us. It is there because, as Swami says, that we are essentially divine and that divine's nature is unconditional love. But it is covered by this sheath of likes and dislikes, and that is what we have to work with. Right, thanks Sister Purna for this question, and it gave us an opportunity to look at it from a maybe a slightly different angle. Much of what I said, I think I must have said in all the answers before, but just put in a different form, and I hope it was more like a revision and a reiteration to each one of us in our minds. So thank you, Sister Purna, for asking this question. If you have anything more to clarify about this, feel free to write to me at prem@radiosaiyan.org. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. If you have a question on practical spirituality that you would like me to address on the show, feel free to write to me. My personal mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. If you can record your question in your own voice and send it across, that would be wonderful. I always like to play the question in the voice of the person who's asking the question. If you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. I'll not mention your name. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with, again, one of my favorite songs, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it too. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Sam Prakash for the last segment of this Thursday, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week at 7:30 for the next episode of Radio Sai.
She solaces.